Coming up, the Supreme Court ended its term this past week with several decisions important to faith communities. It ruled on abortion, immigration, the contraception mandate, and affirmative action in college admissions. We analyze the rulings. Also, 10 years after the horrible schoolhouse massacre in Amish country in Pennsylvania, David Tereshchik reports on the faith and forgiveness that followed. And for Muslims, the holy month of Ramadan ends this coming week with Eid al-Fitr.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernathy. It's good to have you with us. Catholic bishops were among those condemning the sharp rise in xenophobic and racist attacks following Britain's vote to leave the European Union. The British National Police Chief said they had received 85 complaints of hate crimes between June 23rd, the day the UK voted for Brexit, and June 26th, a 57% increase in hate crime reports compared to the same period last month. Reports included incidents of vandalism and verbal abuse. Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby accused people of using the EU referendum as an excuse to vent hatred. Pope Francis prayed for the victims of the terrorist attack at the Istanbul airport that claimed at least 41 lives. He also asked that God would convert the hearts of the violent. Earlier in the week at a Vatican ceremony, Francis made a rare joint appearance with his predecessor, Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI. The event was meant to mark the 65th anniversary of Benedict's ordination as a priest, but the ceremony was also aimed at putting to rest recent questions about the roles played by the current and former popes, with Francis insisting there is only one pope. Before the unprecedented ceremony, Pope Francis created controversy when he told reporters that the Catholic Church owed gays, women, and the poor an apology. Aboard a plane taking him back to Rome from Armenia, Francis said homosexuals should not be discriminated against, and repeated a slightly modified version of his now famous remark, "Who am I to judge?" Two dozen Syrian organizations and humanitarian aid groups are threatening to pull out of peace talks unless more is done to protect civilians and to end the Syrian conflict, now in its sixth year. Meanwhile, nearly 1,000 Muslims, Sikhs, Jews, Buddhists, Christians, and Hindus gathered in New York City to make care packages for Syrian refugees. The packages included toothpaste, nail clippers, soap, and other personal hygiene products. The event was organized by the relief organization Heart to Heart International with the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee and the Multifaith Alliance for Syrian Refugees. The hygiene kits are bound for refugee camps in Turkey. The Presbyterian Church in America repented for past racial sins at its General Assembly in Mobile, Alabama. The church confessed and repented for, quote, corporate and historical sins, including those committed during the civil rights era, and continuing racial sins of ourselves and our fathers, such as the segregation of worshipers by race. The denomination also confessed to past participation in white supremacist organizations. Meanwhile, the Presbyterian Church USA, which also met this month, passed several resolutions aimed at pressuring Israel, among them urging a realty company to stop sales of property within Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. Our frequent guest here, Father Tom Reese, has been elected the new chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. We congratulate him and wish him well. As it wrapped up its current term, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a number of decisions important to religious communities. In a 5-3 decision this past week, the Supreme Court struck down a restrictive Texas law that proponents argued was needed to protect the health of women seeking an abortion. The court concluded that the law did not provide significant medical benefits, but substantially restricted access to abortions, violating the federal constitution. The court's decision on Monday was its most significant ruling on abortion rights since 1992. Earlier this month, the Supreme Court announced that it had deadlocked in a case challenging President Obama's immigration plan. The split decision set no national precedent, but left in place a lower court ruling that said the president lacked the authority to shield up to 4 million immigrants from deportation without approval from Congress. Many religious groups expressed disappointment with the ruling, calling it a major setback for immigrant families. In another decision, the Supreme Court handed affirmative action supporters a major victory. In a 4-3 vote, the court rejected a challenge to a race-conscious admissions program at the University of Texas at Austin. And the Supreme Court declined in May to rule in a highly watched case about the extent to which faith-based nonprofits can be exempt from the government's mandate that employers provide contraception coverage for employees. Citing legal briefs with possible compromises, the justices threw out all previous rulings and told lower courts to revisit the issue. In the meantime, the court said religious groups may not be fined if they don't comply. The case was brought by religious nonprofits who said their religious freedom was being violated. On this issue, faith groups come down on both sides. Our managing editor, Kim Lawton, is here to analyze the court's work, and so is Richard Wolf, who covers the court for USA Today. To both of you, welcome. Rich, what impressed you particularly about this court?
Well, this was an interesting term of the court, largely because of the death of Justice Scalia in the middle of the session. And as a result, they had to reach a lot of sort of compromises, creative decisions, shall we say, in a couple of cases, the immigration case being a notable one. They tied 4-4 in the contraception case. This is the Affordable Care Act case. They really kicked it back to the lower courts and decided nothing whatsoever and left it up to the local courts to decide. So in a lot of these cases involving religion and other things, they had to be much more creative than they've been in the past for deciding how, trying to decide how they could dispose of these cases with an even number of justices.
A lot of effect still on religious communities.
Well, in both of those cases that we just mentioned, the religious community was very active on the activist level of filing briefs before the court, but also in that grassroots mobilizing, encouraging the court, for example, on immigration. There was a very diverse coalition of religious groups. Some people that might be more politically conservative, evangelicals, joining with some that were more politically liberal in the faith-based community on that issue. Now, the court really took up, or the lower courts had taken up, the issue of whether the president had the authority to make the decision. But for these groups, it's a matter of justice and caring for the immigrant. And so they are still going to be agitating on that issue, even though we didn't have a real decision on that.
But there's one thing, Kim and Rich, one thing that keeps kind of coming up through in all the discussion of it, this idea of religious freedom. People using this, my religious freedom is being abridged by something that the court
And does. This has been a court which in recent years, and going back actually for a couple of decades, has been pretty accommodating to those fighting for religious freedom. There have been cases just in the past couple of years, the Hobby Lobby case, which was the earlier contraception case, a case having to do with prayers at town board meetings up in upstate New York, case having to do with signs on roads in Arizona. Without going into detail, all of these cases ended up on the side of religious freedom. The court has generally been a little bit to the right of center on that issue, but there's reason to believe that that might be changing now. With the 8-member court, with the potential nomination of Merrick Garland or someone else that might come, say, from a Clinton presidency, you might have a situation where favoring religious freedom suddenly turns to not favoring religious freedom.
A lot of these cases, the contraception case in particular, is pitting rights against rights. And so you have reproductive rights and religious rights. And when, or in previous cases before, it was gay marriage and then religious rights to dissent from that. And when you have rights coming together and clashing, a lot of these religious groups, especially on the conservative side, have been very worried about whether religion will have the upper hand like it has sometimes in the past. And that's been also really interesting on the election. It has political implications because a lot of these conservative groups have really latched onto that issue and are raising it for this election to say, look, we may not like Donald Trump, but he's at least given us verbal assurances that he would appoint conservative justices in the future. So it's interesting how that's become a political issue, too.
The religious liberty thing is also playing out post same-sex marriage with a lot of laws in states, mostly southern states, but others that have to do with anti-discrimination laws, non-discrimination laws. The gay lesbian community is still fighting for all of that.
And accommodation for religious beliefs, how much do they get accommodated in that?
And pushback from state legislatures, from the more conservative state legislatures, the transgender issue and all this. So even with same-sex marriage being such a landmark case, plenty more to play out in the LGBT versus religious freedom area as well.
Quickly, Rich, the court is changing, and a lot of people are saying is going to be changing a lot more in the near future.
Yes, so we've got this 8-member court right now. We're in limbo because the Republicans won't confirm or do anything with the nomination of Merrick Garland. But we're in a situation where we have a Democratic president and the death of a nominee from a Republican president, perhaps the most conservative of justices, Nino Scalia. Huge difference there depending on who gets to nominate and confirm the next justice. And then in the future, we have Justice Ginsburg, who is 83, Justice Kennedy, who is 80, and Justice Breyer, who is 78. And depending on who's president, you could have dramatic changes in the ideological makeup of the court.
And again, it's not just the conservatives. Both, in the faith-based community, both liberals and conservatives are exactly raising those points when they're asking people to make their decision for November.
Many thanks to you, Kim. And many thanks to Rich Wolf of USA Today.
Thanks.
This year is the 10th anniversary of what the Amish people in Pennsylvania call the Happening. In the village of Nickel Mines in Lancaster County, a heavily armed young milk truck driver, not Amish, entered an Amish schoolhouse and murdered 5 girls, wounded 5 more, and then killed himself. Correspondent David Taraschuk reports from Amish country, both on what happened and on the extraordinary demonstrations ever since of faith and forgiveness.
The Amish community of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania calls it The Happening. It took place on October 2, 2006, when the quiet village of Nickel Mines suffered one of America's most sickening mass shootings. A local milk truck driver named Charlie Roberts entered an Amish schoolhouse with an arsenal of weaponry. He let the boys and the teacher go, but tied up and then shot 10 girls, killing 5 of them and seriously wounding the other 5. And then killed himself as police stormed the building.
That was such a horrific event for this area. And for somebody to do that to Amish students who were known to be people that aren't acquainted with violence at all and very peaceful people. So for that to happen in an Amish school was just unbelievable. Nobody could believe it.
These five small trees commemorate the five girls killed between the ages of 7 and 13. A decade later, the ripple effect of their deaths has been felt not just among the Amish, but in the community at large as well.
I would wake up and the tears would actually be streaming from my eyes before I had a conscious thought.
Terry Roberts was among the many people affected forever by the killings. She's the mother of the killer, Charlie Roberts. Not Amish, but a devout Christian who raised her children to be Christian, too. On the day of the shootings, she believed her son might have gone to the school to help in some way and was worried he himself might have been shot by the killer.
When I pulled in, the state trooper and my husband were standing right before me. And I looked at the trooper and I said, "Is my son alive?" "No, ma'am." And then I looked at my husband and he said, "It was Charlie. He killed those girls."
Back at their own home, still in shock, Terry and her husband, Chuck, had a visitor from among the Amish.
All day long, my husband could not lift his head. And he would keep repeating, "Those poor women, those poor children, the poor parents, the poor fathers. We will never be able to face our Amish neighbors again." But day one, a knock came on the door, and it was Henry, our Amish neighbor from across the street. Henry walked over to my husband and just started massaging his shoulders and says, "Roberts, we love you. We don't hold anything against you. We want you as our neighbor."
Since that day, Terry has had a special label for her neighbor.
So I call Henry my angel in black. You know, the Amish wear all black garb, but he was my angel in black that day, just with his acceptance and his love and this message of forgiveness.
Forgiveness and acceptance were amplified in the days that followed. There were massively attended funerals for the five dead girls. There was also, of course, a burial for Terry's son, the killer, an event full of dread for the family as it inevitably attracted intense media attention. And then, the bereaved Amish parents turned up for the Roberts funeral.
Walking on the grass over toward the area where our son would be buried, and just to see this procession of parents coming out and surrounding us was, there just aren't words to describe. It was a protective circle against all those media trucks out on the street, had their big telescoping lenses, and yet here we were. It just felt secure.
The Amish are known for living apart from the modern world, shunning much technology, and rarely, if ever, publicizing their community's affairs. At Pennsylvania's Elizabethtown College, Donald Crabill studies Anabaptist faith groups, which include the Amish.
News reporters would ask me, "Well, were the Amish prepared for this? Do they have emergency preparedness drills in their schools?" Well, no, they don't, but they had forgiveness preparedness. They were ready to respond when events like this come. The Amish response at Nickel Mines was not robotic. It was quick, and that doesn't mean it was thoughtless, doesn't mean it was easy, but they knew it was the right thing to do.
Amish forgiveness was seen as striking in the shooting's immediate aftermath, but it has also extended over time and taken very practical forms. Huge cash donations flooded in to help families of the murdered and injured children. Some of the money, though, was deliberately channeled by the Amish to the killer's widow and children. They decided to move away from the area.
I spoke to a father who lost a daughter in the schoolhouse, and I said to him, Abner, I said, how would you define forgiveness? Well, he said, "For me, it's giving up my right to revenge."
In Terry Roberts' case, Amish forgiveness has continued in a very tangible way as she and her husband have remained in the same home. It now has a sunroom, a gift from Amish builders.
Wow, that really was so instrumental in my healing. Just to know that love was poured out for us and to have such a room of contentment and peace and calm to come into every day.
Peace and calm have become even more important now since Terry has cancer that is late stage and has taken over much of her body. But she has been more than a recipient of kindness from the Amish. She has held tea parties in this sunroom for local Amish women and until the surviving girls and their friends grew up, there were often children's parties in her yard as well. She devotes special attention to one surviving but badly injured girl.
Five of them survived, but Rosanna is still tube-fed and in a wheelchair. I went to Rosanna's house every week on Thursday nights, and I would rock her and sing to her and help bathe her. She's 15 now, so I don't hold her anymore, but she's a beautiful young woman. And I feel tears in my eyes now because, yeah, it's just incredible that this child now comes to visit me. And then she came again in December when all the families came in a yellow school bus and sang Christmas carols to me.
At the local non-denominational worship center, there's been much reflection on the past decade, especially from its lead minister. Pastor Smucker says the population in general has benefited from this example of Amish grace.
Everything is coming from a peaceful standpoint, and that's how they responded. It was amazing, and the whole community saw that and in turn responded with them, so to speak.
For the College Chronicler of Amish Life and Belief, the Roberts family's singular experience has proved a powerful instance of healing compassion being driven by religious conviction.
One Amish father told me the Roberts family had a much heavier burden than we did. They have to bear the shame and the stigma of this whole thing. We wanted to reach out to them because we care about them.
And for Terry Roberts herself, her life over the decades since the happening has led her to take stock deeply and afresh.
Every day I wake up with the question of how many days do I have yet on this earth because of stage 4 cancer? I mean, this is nearly 10 years after the tragedy, and here I am. I am alive because of the response of the Amish, because of forgiveness. I believe so much light has been brought into such a dark place.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is David Tereshchuk in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Finally, this coming week, Muslims around the world observe Eid al-Fitr, the 3-day festival marking the end of Ramadan. During the holy month of Ramadan, Muslims who are able are called upon to fast from sunrise to sunset. Imam Johari Abdul Malik, Director of Community Outreach for the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia, describes the transition from Ramadan to the Eid.
You know, when we think about a month that is starving the body, but then you have to figure out how do you feed your soul? The process of withdrawing from the things that really drive you causes you in a sense to feel I have to rely on God for my energy. Something that you really can't prepare for is the feeling that you will miss Ramadan when it's over. And so I encourage people, prepare yourself so that when the month ends, you don't have remorse, that you did what you could do, and then be grateful. Saturday and Sunday will be days of fun and play, especially for children. So we'll have moon bounce, we'll have rides. It's a day of fun, it's a day of joy, and it's summertime. And so in the summertime, we celebrate like that. On the day of Eid al-Fitr, every family will donate to provide for a family of their size. It's called Zakat al-Fitr. I have to duplicate my joy for that day and share it with others so that it really is a day that everyone in the community should have. It's going to be an opportunity to enjoy a light but quick breakfast and then to come to the mosque to listen to a short sermon with 2 units of prayer, and in that sermon, it is going to be a reminder about the great success that we have made as humanity. We have all come out of it with a renewed spirit and a renewed conviction. And so it is about celebration. It is about people congratulating one another that we survived the month of Ramadan.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you this 4th of July weekend, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir singing God Bless America.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.